It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to the Over the Monster podcast. We are getting closer and closer to spring training edition, which can only mean one thing. Site manager Dan Secatori is sad because he hates spring training. Dan, are you sad?
That's not quite true. And in fact, today's kind of a very spring-like day. It's very sunny. There's birds. And I dropped the kids off at school and headed back to the house. And I was like, I could use a split squad game in Sarasota this afternoon. I think I'm ready for it.
See, it just, the hating dies away when the television gets, actually it probably wouldn't even be on television.
It really, isn't it amazing how that happens? Just like, yeah, I mean, like I said last week, I'm still going to watch I'm going to tune in to at least parts of every spring training game. I will never make it all nine. Only sickos would ever make it all nine, but yeah. Well, it's this time of year, it's Caribbean series season. You know,
WBC season.
You know, the Super Bowl to me means baseball is coming. I haven't even watched a complete Super Bowl in years.
That's very un-American of you, and I applaud you on that. Bill Lee would be very proud of you.
So you slacked me that you were heading up to the Vineyard to watch the Super Bowl. I wasn't sure if we were going to do this podcast while you were on a ferry on the high seas, going through Long Island Sound or whatever. Are you coming home just to watch the Super Bowl?
First of all, it's not Long Island Sound. It's Vineyard Sound. Long Island Sound is next to Long Island.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of how sounds and geography work. Presumably the ferry you would take from New York would at one point.
I don't take the ferry from New York.
How do you take it from
Woods Hole?
To New Bedford?
To Woods Hole. Oh, actually, okay. You know what? I hadn't thought about it till you mentioned it. Maybe I should just drive to New Bedford. Actually, I could see if the Rhode Island ferry is running.
Is there a Rhode Island ferry? Why don't you just take one of those helicopters that leaves from Wall Street? Why don't you just do that?
Die?
Oh, that's the reason.
Going to watch with my brother who just moved back and got some good news about his health that, let's just say, could have been bad and wasn't. And so,
that's good.
I'll spend a few days up there and bring the dog, let the dog Run Free on the Empty Beach, which is all I've ever wanted in my life. But then I'll come back and we'll be closer to spring training games. And yeah, sickos will watch all nine innings, but
wait. Hold on. I got a question for you about, I got a question for an island related question for you.
Sure.
So I was looking at some of our site metrics the other day. You know, at the end of the day, I check to see like what stories are getting the most traction and whatnot. And every now and again, I scroll to the bottom just because I'm always curious to see like what completely random and old stories from like 6 or 8 or 10 years ago have for some reason been read like 4 or 5 times that particular day. And the other day, for some reason, I stumbled across a story that got like five views. It was several years old. The headline was Pedro Martinez, Hall of Famer, Muse, and Lobster Roll Spokesman by one Brian Joyner. And I'm gonna read the lead right here because I had a question about that. I have several questions about this.
Go for it.
So here we go. It's beautiful writing, by the way. You know, nothing to be ashamed of here. Baseball fans.
I used to be able to do that.
We'll talk about that later in the pod. Baseball fans grow up hearing about a forever unattainable past, whether it's a generation of New Yorkers sermonizing on Mickey Mantle, or in my case, a neighbor in Maryland dreaming of a new Bob Gibson. Born in Boston and a self-declared Red Sox fan, I pushed my family to move back to Massachusetts at age 11 to chase the ghosts of Sox past. I wanted to live in a place where the names weren't Mantle or Gibson, but Williams and Yaz. Shockingly, it worked, and we moved back to Massachusetts, where I studied Sox history and waited. Beautiful, beautiful lead. And a great article about that's ultimately about a McDonald's commercial.
But, was the audio clip still in? Oh, the McDonald's commercial. Was the video clip in there?
Yes, it was. I believe it was.
And did I tell you, did I write in the story? The reason I found that video clip was I tweeted about it on the tubes, and someone who followed me already, who worked in advertising, is like, oh yeah, I made that commercial. Let me see if I can find it. And wow, that's how I got the clip.
Yeah, because that was well pre the YouTube era and everything. Wow, that's interesting. Yeah. You should put that up on YouTube. So wait, we should start a YouTube page and put that up on YouTube. I think people would like to see that.
Didn't I do that though? How you saw it?
Maybe you did. Well, it was just embedded in
it. It was many years ago.
Yeah, it was. Well, anyway, so my question is, are you trying to tell me that you, as an 11-year-old child, forced your family to move to Martha's Vineyard so that you could be close to the Red Sox and then move to an island where you could not get to Fenway Park?
Forced is not the right word, but the rest is 100% correct. And
how does an 11-year-old child have control over his family in such a manner?
Here's how. My parents were divorced. We live with my mom. My uncle, who is independently wealthy, was taking summer vacations in Eastern resort towns because he had a Sox store that he had opened in Dallas and was looking to expand.
Sox store, not a Red Sox store.
Yes, but with an amazing name. Something's afoot.
So the puns run in your family.
So, yes. So, really, I think the store was as much an excuse to take vacations to places that they might want to put the store as much as it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. So, the first year we went to Corning, New York with them and like Finger Lakes.
I love the Finger Lakes. All right, real quick sidebar upstate New York vacation discussion. The Finger Lakes are like such a great under the radar vacation spot. If you like, the Finger Lakes are right now what the Catskills were like 15 years ago. Like they're going to be really big. They're going to be like where all the Brooklynites go to vacation in 15 years. But right now it's still pristine and wild. It's great. Not wild, it's all farmland, but you know, it's great.
Freshwater destinations are trash and should be disallowed.
I generally do. I generally agree with you again, as we discussed, growing up semi-coastal New England, but Lake Cayuga is fucking beautiful. It really is.
It's pretty. Yes. They're very pretty.
Yeah. But the swimming does kind of suck.
So we went to the Vineyard for vacation, and I was reading, I remember very vividly, the Ron Luciano series of books. He was an umpire, and he wrote three books about being an umpire. Most of them were basically about fighting with Earl Weaver, and they're great. And I was 11, and I loved watching the Red Sox on this vacation on the Vineyard, because I was already a Red Sox fan, because I had been born in Boston, and I lived outside of D.C., where there was no Nationals.
Right.
And most people's families around where I live came from someplace else. So there were a lot of Orioles fans, but my best friend was a Royals fan. And it just never occurred to me to be an Orioles fan. So we're watching, and I say, hey, Mom, and this is, I'm 11. Let's move here. She said, find me a job. I went and I got the Vineyard Gazette. I circled a job, said librarian, town librarian.
Did you really?
6 months later, we moved.
Wow. That is like, that sounds like a kind of 90s family movie script. Like,
it really,
finding a job for his mom so that he can watch his favorite baseball team.
You know what would be awesome? If my 7-year-old could find me a job.
You know what? Every year, it's not the Vineyard, so I don't know if this would be a problem for you. I don't know if you have a big rivalry with this island, but like every year, the Boston Globe rewrites the same article about how hard it is to get people to move to and work on Cutty Hunk. So,
I have no beef with Cutty Hunk. I've been there once or twice. Yeah, I mean, people who don't,
it's a dry island, so
people who don't, I'll tell you one thing, there's no dry island. Having lived island life and now seen Banshees of Inisherin, which is the greatest look at sort of just the dynamics of island life. Mm-hmm. What people who think the Vineyard is like Boonies, because some people do, despite the fact it's Obama. I mean, Obama.
You mean like what Ron DeSantis thinks the Vineyard is after Labor Day?
I don't think Ron DeSantis thinks. Politics. Cutty Hunk is like, that's they, like, those people are hard as fuck.
Oh, I mean, yeah, they'd have to be.
I thought you were going to say
they're just living out alone on a rock.
The Nan word. And I was like, yeah, of course, I hate them. But,
Yeah, so Cutty Hunk, you respect, Nantucket, you hate.
Yeah, and then I've also been to Penikees, which is the farthest most Elizabeth Island in the chain the Cutty Hunk is on, and that was a former leper colony that is now, that has no electricity, that that is now like a place they send kids who need special attention, blah, 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 who've gotten in trouble on the mainland, blah, 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 to live together and work the land. And it's a very small island.
Yeah.
Like very, very small. You can walk across it in like 45 minutes at most. And my stepfather actually used to work at that house. Anyhow, that's how I moved there. And that's how, when I was a kid, I watched whatever games I could watch. And as you were saying, only sickos will watch all 9 innings of a spring training game, but OTM is a community of sickos. And to that end, we have a lot of content on the site. Dan, tell us about it.
We do. So we have started our season preview coverage with the spring training, pitchers and catchers next week, but we got an early start. So we have, we are doing three different series to prepare for the upcoming season. So one, we're doing a straightforward positional preview. right now we've already got that started. We're going around the diamond, looking at each position. Phil Neufer has started us off there. He's got third base covered last week. We just published a piece about center field today. Jake Reiser, our newest signing, started us off with the shortstop position preview. And then the other two series have, we have one that we're calling Things We're Excited For in 2023. Bob Osgood wrote about Brian Bello and his work with Pedro Martinez. I wrote about Tristan Casas, and specifically one thing that we mentioned on the pod last week, I wrote specifically about Tristan Casas's very obvious drive and desire to be a star and a very public, public-facing baseball player, and how excited that makes me. And then the third series, we haven't debuted yet. The third series is going to be Things We Are Terrified For in 2023, because this is going to be a volatile season, and it is either going to be exciting or terrifying. So keep that in mind. That's going to be going up on the site until opening day. Brian, what do you have for this season preview coming?
I was going to ask, which one did I write for? I can't remember which one. I mean, certainly the what we're terrified of works, but I have to say, having read your Tristan Casas article right now, I agree with what you say, that novelty is the what makes the world go round, and that's why this year is different to me from the last three, because even though Bogarts is gone and Betts is long gone, there's a lot of novelty with this team, especially
there is Yoshida. I mean, yeah, could you imagine where we're gonna be? Like, what if Yoshida is the American League Player of the Month for the month of April?
I'm probably unrealistically excited about him.
Yeah,
but that's sort of in the absence of other things to be unrealistically excited about. At the same time, no caveat, no real caveat. I'm ready, and hopefully he makes up for it, because is that it for the site wrap up? Other than my interrogation,
that is it for the site wrap up. We also have, if this is your first time looking at the podcast feed, we do have two other pods up this week. The Red Seat came back and did a deep dive into the roster. Pod on Lansdowne came back yesterday and did a deep dive into 80 for Brady. So if that's what you're interested, go check that out.
That's, I think, not all they picked up probably like 80% of the box office of 80 for Brady. Judging from their social media posts,
they seem that, you know, their take was that it was pretty much as good as it could have been. So, you know, hey, you know what I actually read today? It was written by the same screenplay team that wrote Booksmart.
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, Brady got money.
Yeah, yeah. Was this like a Brady production? Is he the executive producer?
He had some hand in it. I remember.
Well, I mean, he's in it, but like, was he like, hey, I want to make a movie about octogenarians who love me?
I don't know the backstory, but I do know that it has only helped the Pod on Lansdowne guys lap us, and specifically me, in terms of putting out quality content, because those guys don't miss. Put on Lansdowne, don't miss. Neither has, in general, I would say, no matter what you argue about Chaim Bloom, outside of the Mookie trade, which didn't get us any minor leaguers, that the Red Sox minor league system is in better shape than it has been in a while. And that is something that Heimlum talked about at the fun winter weekend. But not everyone agrees, because Keith Law came out with a haterific list of the top farm systems at baseball and had the Red Sox 23rd. Dan, are the Red Sox only the 23rd best minor league system in baseball?
I have absolutely no idea. And you don't have any idea. And Keith Law doesn't have any idea. And nobody does. And it's all pointless. which I mean, I wrote a little bit about that when I, so I touched upon Keith Law's rankings, on the site last week, although I did it before he ranked the system as a whole. I just did it with his top 100 because he is a huge outlier. I mean, so he's a big outlier in where he is ranking the Red Sox in general. Most other publications have them somewhere between 10 and 15. So he's a huge outlier there, but he's also an outlier on Rafaela. He has Rafaela as the 37th best prospect in baseball right now. And there was at least one other site. Was it Pipeline? ESPN didn't have Rafaela in the top 100 at all. And he had Rafaela ahead of Casas, who's already put up like a 110 WRC plus in a month of major league play. So look, on the one hand, as I wrote in the Rafaela piece, like it literally doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where these prospects, where these farm systems are ranked, right? Like there's no AP poll that's going to give any material benefit to the team with the number one farm system. It doesn't matter at all. And they're frequently, they can be way off. When I wrote that Rafaela piece, I dug into some numbers. Obviously, look, we know that number one prospects miss all the time, whether it's like Delmon Young was the number one prospect, Jerks and Profar was the number one prospect like 2 years in a row. The San Diego Padres were the number one system in 2012, and then they went under 500 for each of the next 10 seasons. So on the one hand, like, who gives a shit? Nobody actually knows how good the system is. You can only know in retrospect how good a system is, right? So we shouldn't get too riled up on this. On the other hand, it does seem kind of impossible. If you're starting with Meyer and you are conceding that he's a top 10 in all of baseball prospect, as Keith Law does, and then if you're Keith Law and if you're also saying Sedane Rafaela is a potential future star, I mean, he's saying his view of Rafaela right now is, one, he's potentially the best. He could one day be the best outfielder in baseball defensively, which is a fairly commonly held view. He really is thought to be that outstanding with the glove. He's an outstanding athlete. His biggest problem right now is that he has a terrible approach at the plate. But Law is saying if he can close that approach, and I guess he thinks there's at least a chance that he does, then he's going to be a guy who's a gold glove center fielder who hits 20 home runs with a high batting average, which would make him one of the absolute best players in the game. So if you have Meyer as a top 10 prospect, if you have Rafaela, who Law is higher on than any other prospect evaluator in the industry, and then you have Casas, who Law still likes. Casas, he says Casas is going to be like a traditional slugging high OBP first baseman who's either going to hit a shit ton of doubles or see those doubles turn into 30, 40 home run seasons. That's an all-star too. And then, of course, he has Miguel Blaze at the back end of the list. And who the hell knows what Miguel Blaze is going to be right now. He's 19 years old. So it's hard to, like, if you're that excited about those three guys, then how could the system possibly be that bad? It does seem a little strange. But again, like I said, it also doesn't matter. So what's your take?
My take is the same. There's a lot of top prospects who it's so hard to parse out these lists because In Law's case, he's looking, okay, what is the possible peak of Rafaela? And let's rank him around the probability of hitting that peak. But then you mention a guy like Profar, and I'm thinking of a guy like Alex Gordon or even the guy like Benintendi, who were all the number one prospects at the time. And they're all belong in the major leagues, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it took them longer to like find their footing.
Well, Alex Benintendi went backwards.
Right. Yeah. But like Alex Gordon became over the course of like 5-6 years.
Yeah.
A player, but it just
after being demoted a couple of times, I think, too, right?
Profar is a useful Major League Baseball player. Yeah. He's not signed to a team right now, but that speaks to the fact that he's just a useful player. He's a useful role player. Now, ultimately, that has value, but doesn't have the same value as a top outfielder the top outfielder in baseball, all things considered. You also get a case like Jared Kelenic, right? Who was not the number one prospect, but was pretty close to it. And can't hit. I mean, when he hits the ball, it goes far. He just can't do that. The flip side is there's a guy like Julio Rodriguez who just comes in and sets the world on fire. But that is the very, very rare case. Even a guy like Wander Franco, who was the number one prospect for like 2.5 years, I think at least, is very good. And he's still like 21. he's very good, but he's not, you know, he didn't put up Julio Rodriguez numbers last year.
No.
So,
I mean, he missed a lot of time. He very well could this year.
Yeah.
There's at least a 10% chance that at the end of this season, he's like one of the 10 best players in baseball.
There's a little bit of David Price postseason thing going on where I think about Wander in that series 2 years ago against the Red Sox. And this is not last year, 2 years ago.
Right.
Where
popcorn series.
He just hit lots of home runs.
Yeah.
He was very good. But he is also one of the exceptions. So, yeah, I'm just keeping a note of a little doubt about the Sox minor league system. But, again, with the caveat that you said, it doesn't matter because these are subjective.
It doesn't matter. And look, Law may end up being right. And the other thing about system rankings too is, you know, I mean, I start off by at the top by saying it literally doesn't matter because we don't know. But even if we did know, there really isn't a drastic difference between the 10th best farm system and the 23rd. Like there really isn't.
Even mentions my boy Nico Cavadas, who I love.
Yeah, you do love him, huh? He didn't look so good after promotion last year, but we'll see. I mean, he could be, I don't know, he's a college hitter.
He could be Bobby Dalbec.
That's maybe the best case scenario for him. I don't know. We'll see. I'm not
with a better name.
Yeah, I'm not a Cavadas believer. If you are, go for it. Hey,
I don't know if I'm a believer, but I am a.
You just like you just I like
would
a big.
I would like it to happen.
You're just like a big giant bopper named Nico.
Speaking of things that
we have two Nicos in the system right now. By the way, that's got to be a first. Nico Cavadas, Nico Goodrum.
That's probably
be a first.
Nico that's Goodrum. I mean, is he really a minor leaguer though? I know he's in the system.
Yeah. He's going to be on the opening day roster. I guarantee.
Yeah, definitely.
Guaranteed. Because right now, the way the roster is constructed, if like Christian Arroyo slams into a wall going after a foul ball and needs to take like 3 days off, that means Bobby Dalbec is the second baseman. And God forbid if it's Kike Hernandez crashing into the wall, well, then Arroyo moves to short and Bobby plays second. So that's the way the roster is constructed right now. They literally don't have a backup middle infielder. So unless we think Profar hasn't even played short in years. So I guess unless we think Andrews or Iglesias is coming on, and I don't see it at this point. Maybe it seems like they're – if they want Andrews, they really only want him on a 1-year deal, and he thinks he's better than that. And he probably will get a 2-year deal somewhere. So I think Nico Goodrum is going to be on the opening day roster.
Probably, but Elvis, it's getting late, Elvis. It's getting late.
It is getting late. I mean, Trevor Story still wasn't signed at this point last year.
That's a good point.
But that was
someone who is on the Red Sox is Justin Turner. And it was revealed this week that a big reason why was Enrique Hernandez hounding him and recruiting him to come to the Red Sox because he felt that Turner would bring a presence to the clubhouse that they sorely lacked, having played with Turner in Los Angeles. And apparently it worked. and now Turner's here. Dan, what did you read into this whole situation? Because it seemed to be a lot of, I mean, it's Kike, so he's the coolest guy.
Yeah.
But it does seem like there was a little bit of implied criticism here.
Yeah. So. Well, there were two interesting things, I think, about what he said about Turner. Putting the criticism in the back burner for a second. I just thought it was more funny than interesting, I guess, that he's talked about how he recruited both Kenley and Justin Turner via text, at least. We don't know how hard these recruiting pushes were. But he said, like, yeah, Kenley was really easy to convince, but Justin Turner took a while. that's interesting to me that Justin Turner was so hesitant to come here. I mean, we hear about these recruiting pitches all the time, but have we ever once heard of a player being recruited to a team that offered him only the second or third most money? Like, Jansen and Turner are both here because the Red Sox offered them the most money, right?
So that's, I thought of that too, that it really made it sound like a collaborative process or value added from Kike. Maybe it was, and maybe there was some value added, but when it comes down to it, my thought was, well, he's not the GM, you know. It's,
well, he's asking for a bonus. In the interview, he asked for a bonus from
Bloomberg. Yeah, I don't think he's gonna get that. It's just interesting because he made it very clear that they needed a different type of presence, and he felt that Turner brought that.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, yeah, last season was depressing as fuck. And I think we all knew that. But on the other hand, it's not like Julian Tavares was in the clubhouse or something like that. I mean, is he really, like, is he taking a shot at, well, so the innuendo that people started putting together a couple of weeks ago was that this was about Matt Barnes, because as soon the night that Matt Barnes was DFA'd, or maybe it was, or I don't know if it was the night he was DFA'd or if it was the night that the Blyer trade was completed, Kike sent out a tweet that said, "I like my team." That's the tweet.
Oh wow!
Which the timing was pretty curious. So I don't know if Matt Barnes, of all people, was a problematic figure in the clubhouse or not. Apparently, I didn't listen to Karabas's podcast because why would I ever listen to any other podcasts? But apparently,
hey, you're speaking my language.
But apparently, Matt Barnes went on and kind of we should listen to this a little bit more deeply. Apparently, he kind of really went after Haim. So maybe he was pretty vocally negative in the clubhouse last year. But look, like last year was a disaster of a season, and you know, of course, it's going to be a bad clubhouse when you consider how ugly things were on field for most of the season. And then, you know, let's talk about the elephant in the room here. If this is a Xander thing, yeah, I don't blame Xander for being depressed as fuck last year. You know, why wouldn't he be? His future was uncertain. He felt disrespected by his own front office. The market later very much agreed with him that he was being disrespected. So he probably wasn't happy last year. That doesn't mean he was a clubhouse cancer. It probably just means he wasn't happy and the team was bad and none of them were happy. It could be as simple as that. It could just be like Kike being like, man, last year was not fun. And Justin Turner is a fun guy, so maybe this year will be fun. It could be as simple as that.
I agree with you. And I think that GMs do have a very difficult time with especially baseball GMs, like, above and beyond baseball GMs, putting together a team while accounting for the clubhouse dynamics, when we've seen teams that are 25 guys, 25 caps win the World Series, you know,
right.
It's, they don't have to get along, but if they're winning, it's fine. When they're not winning, I think the resentment over not winning can grow and then metastasize into like, well, we're not getting along because you didn't put together a team that gets along. And it's all when it comes down to it about winning and losing. But I, you know, you don't have to look anywhere beyond the 2012 season followed by the 2013 season to know these things can flip on a dime.
Yeah.
Because we had one of the most dysfunctional teams I can ever remember, followed by the miracle team.
Yeah. And well, it seems like this did flip on a dime from 2001 to 2022 too.
Yeah,
which is interesting. I mean, obviously there was a ton
actually of went back. It went back and forth. It went from 2020, 2021, 2022.
Yeah. Well, 2020, whatever, you can throw that in the garbage.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, between 2012 and 2013, there was a ton of roster turnover. There wasn't really any roster turnover. Well, there was some between 2021 and 2022. It was pretty much the same group of guys.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens, because this is there's a lot of new faces now, and it's unknown, it's novel, and it's fun. But it did get us thinking about the biggest clubhouse cancers.
Wait, are we doing biggest?
Or... No. We're just doing a list. We're just drafting okay, clubhouse
just,
cancers.
Yeah. Sorry. I initially was thinking my favorite clubhouse cancer.
Sure. That's fine.
Which was a combination of guys I like and also which clubhouse cancerous behavior was the most fun.
That's awesome.
But I'm also not sure my list ended up reflecting even that definition.
I think this is very much vibes list, and we will get to these lists after this break.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And we're back. We are ready to draft Red Sox clubhouse cancers, our favorite, the biggest, whatever we feel like. Basically, our favorite examples of malcontent Sox and how these malcontents express themselves. Dan, you may go first.
I am going to go first, and I am going to get us started on a depressing note, but I just have to get this out of the way early so we can move on, because what I'm about to say is going to break both my current heart and the heart of 12-year-old Dan. Yeah. This was a really foundational clubhouse cancer moment for me in my baseball fandom. I hate that I'm about to say it. Get it over with. The last years of Nomar were just so bad and depressing, weren't they?
I think it was really the last year, but yes. Everything after he got hit in the wrist. I mean, that's really, it's sliding.
And I don't blame him. He is a tragic figure. Now that I'm older, and now that we've won the World Series four times.
Okay, Sam.
What's that?
I said, okay, Sam Kennedy.
Sorry, you're right. Okay, fair enough. But no, now that we're older and I don't have the hunger and drive to win at all costs now, I can appreciate Nomar not only for like what he was to me as a kid, but now I can appreciate his role as a tragic figure in kind of a literary way, like a literary Red Sox way. I mean, he was the prince who was promised. who was put on the cover of ESPN magazine, headline Mission Impossible, No More Sox Win the World Series. And he was perfect in every way and couldn't handle the pressure and needed to be sacrificed by the village in order for them to defeat the beasts at the gate. And it's a shame it went down that way. But now that I can look back on his story, like, there's something poetic and romantic about it. But there's no question his last year was ugly.
Yeah, and he was never like a bubbly figure. Like, and his sort of,
well, he was never bubbly. He was always very good, though. In, you know, in terms, I mean, of,
he was, yes,
with, but the,
he
was fans also, and with the media.
Well, but part of that was he was also insanely good when he was good.
Yeah, but I'll never forget. So he was a rookie. He came up in 96, rookie year 97. They made the playoffs for the first time in 98 with him. And that was the first year that Pedro came on board too. He was so goddamn good in that ALDS against the Indians in 98. But they lost. And I will never forget the image of him. Do you remember they lost at Fenway?
Yes, because Tom Gordon blew his first save of the year.
Yeah. And when they were down to the last out, and it was, and he wasn't doing this to rile up the fans. It was like clear that it was over. Right. He came out of the dugout and just started clapping, just like as the game was going on, it was like clapping to the fans and clapping to the field. And it was just like, it was such an interesting, I've never really seen an athlete do that before. Just saying like, hey, you're like, thank you guys. We're here. We're coming back. So you're right. He wasn't bubbly, but he was great in that sense. He was great with the fans and the media.
Yeah. And
I mean, he was great with the media until he ended up putting a red tape line on the clubhouse floor, right, to keep them away from him.
Right. My best Nomar story is a friend of mine who is from New York City, had never been to the Vineyard. We get into the ferry dock and we go straight to a bar, like the most towny bar I could imagine.
The Black Dog.
We walk in, called the Ocean View, that doesn't even have an ocean view. It just burnt down actually a few months ago, which sucks because it's a great bar. Free popcorn, so you know it's good. But we get in, we literally sit down. It's in the third inning of a game. Second we sit down, Nomar hits a double off the wall, and this guy next to us goes, "Attaboy, Nomar!" And I was like, "Well, welcome to the Vineyard. You're here." But yeah, that was sad. He was obviously on my list. I will go next, and I'm gonna go a little bit outside the box here too. I'm gonna pick a manager. I'm gonna pick Bobby Valentine.
Yeah, that's a hell of a pick.
Talk about the vibes being off. It's one thing for the vibes being off because you're losing, but then it's another thing for the vibes being off and you are actively making the vibes. You're losing and you're making the vibes worse. Yeah. This was supposed to be the giant homecoming. He's a Connecticut
New England guy.
He's literally a Connecticut sports, high school sports legend.
Mm-hmm. Japanese baseball legend.
Japanese baseball legend. Mets slapstick comedy legend. And he came and in 1 year torpedoed. I mean, he was always known to be abrasive. Like, that, it wasn't a surprise that Bobby Valentine was sort of a dick.
Yeah.
But man, he packed a lot into 1 year.
He sure did. He really did. I was excited about the hire initially.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I thought at the very worst, it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
And it was not.
No, it was not.
It was the exact opposite. Yeah. And the Red Sox have subsequently had previously and subsequently have made, I think, really good manager choices. I mean, Cora's obviously been great. Mm-hmm. Francona was great. But the idea of let's get Bobby V in here was just seemed incompatible from the very beginning. It's amazing how often the Red Sox in the last few years have just if the season goes bad, holy smokes, does it go terrible. And
it really, yeah.
And it's not, and the difference between Cora and Valentine, it's like Cora doesn't get any crap for last year. I mean, I don't think he should either. It's just, it happens, man. But with Valentine, it didn't get the sense that this just happens. Like, no, you're doing this.
We'll see. I'm starting to, if the Sox have another bad year, I'm starting to sense a little jinx in Alex Cora's armor. And depending on how bad the Evan Drellich book is, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see about Cora. I mean, I love the guy. The most important part of being baseball manager is obviously man management, and he appears to be outstanding at that. So I will always back him for that reason alone. But yeah, we'll see. The interesting thing about Bobby Valentine, I mean, yes, he was horrible. I don't think Bobby Valentine's the worst Red Sox manager I've ever seen.
I don't think he's the worst manager, but what did you say, Joe Kerrigan?
I was going to say Joe Kerrigan. Yep. And I think Kerrigan was not only worse, but like was also similarly bad at handling the clubhouse in the way that Bobby Valentine was.
I will say that is true, but he had earned his stripes to become the manager in a way that Bobby Valentine had.
Yeah. That was such
a... I mean, he had enough because he was a great... I mean, he got great results as a pitching coach. Mm-hmm. Fine.
He had Pedro Martinez on his rotation, yes. And that helps. You know, in retrospect, were we just like so excited about Tim Wakefield coming out of nowhere that we just attributed everything to Joe Kerrigan? I don't know. Was he really that great of a pitching coach?
Well, probably not. But at the same time, it also didn't surprise me the way that the Bobby Valentine thing surprised me, because Bobby Valentine, as you noted, has a track record of success in many operations. Great sports bar in Greenwich, Connecticut, too. There's baseball cards under the table, under the glass, on every table and around the bar. It's really the cool.
Bobby V sports bar, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
The birthplace of the rap.
Exactly. Exactly.
What a goddamn clown.
Exactly. All right, you're up.
Okay, so my next one, I'm going to tie this one into my first pick. This is going to be a little unfair. I think you're going to be surprised at the name, but I kind of just want to talk about this guy. So I'm going to say my next favorite clubhouse cancer, John Valentin. And he really only had one clubhouse cancerous moment. And like I said, this is tied into it. But of course, he held out. In not holding out for contract, but in Nomar's rookie season, held out during spring training because he did not want to move off of shortstop. And at the time, I was 12 in Nomar's rookie season. And, you know, I think I've discussed before how, like, I used to go to Pawtucket all the time. I was obsessed with prospects as a kid. So I loved the idea of Nomar before he even proved himself to be Nomar. So I was all in on Team Nomar during this protracted standoff between Valentin and the team. But man, like looking back at John Valentin's career up to that point, he was so fucking good. He had a real right.
I mean, he was the best player, arguably, for a couple of years.
Absolutely. 1995. He hit .298, .399 OBP. We didn't know what OBP was back then. So we didn't realize like .399 OBP and a .533 slugging percentage as a shortstop. 27 home runs, 138 OPS plus. He did take a big step back next year, which was the year before Nomar came up, but still he's .296, .374, .436. He was so good. And he had a real right to be like, fuck you. I'm one of the best shortstops in baseball. You're kicking me off the position for an unproven rookie?
I mean, I'll just go into my next one because it's very similar. And the person had much less of a case for keeping their job. It wouldn't be number two on my list in terms of importance, but mine is Shea Hillenbrand.
Oh, yeah. I didn't put him on my list, but I really thought about it. I didn't put him on my list because I didn't have enough time to research all the dumb things he did, but well,
he was mad about them signing Bill Miller.
Yeah.
He was like, I've earned this job. And in the comparison case. Now, look, Bill Miller is not no more, though Bill Miller was very good that year and the year after. Shea Hillenbrand had not done anything outside of very, very early in his career before pitchers realized he will swing at anything and he will not hit it. He had no right to be as pushy as he was about it. And in Theo's defense, Theo was like, great, you're gone.
Yeah. I mean, he was technically, I mean, he made the All-Star team as a 22-year-old, second-year player. But he made the All-Star team with a 105 OPS plus.
Well, this is one of those things where the All-Star team.
We didn't know
team,
back then.
Well, but the All-Star team is also based so dramatically on like what happens in April and May.
Yes, yes, totally. And he had a big April, yeah.
Right, because this is again before pitchers realize we don't need to throw it anywhere near the plate. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
And so,
oh my God, he only had 25 walks that All-Star season. 25 walks in 2002.
And I mean, frankly, the role that Bill Miller played going forward was obviously very important.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no, that
good deal with the Red Sox.
And then he ended up tanking the Blue Jays too. Remember that? Remember he wrote on the clubhouse whiteboard like this is a sinking ship or something at one point when he was at the Jays.
Charming man.
Yeah, what a
charming man.
Yeah, what a jerk he was.
Dovetails with Valentin really well though. Now we've got a left side of the infield disgruntled player.
We do.
All right, you're up.
Okay. So wait, how many rounds do we have left here? I got three more picks. This is tough. I know who I'm ending with, so I really only have two more picks. I don't want to step on your toes. Oh man, this is really
don't worry
really
about hard. It. I got plenty.
All right. I'm going to go with one of my, I think, less interesting ones and more obvious ones. But I'll only go with it because I have something of a personal story. John Lackey goes without saying. Everyone seems to hate John Lackey.
Despite
2013, the centerpiece of the chicken and beer fiasco, a guy who apparently stepped out on his wife after she was diagnosed with cancer, a guy who didn't seem well liked. So my personal story is that I once ended up sitting at a bar next to someone who I presume he's telling the truth, because why would anyone lie about this, claims to have been John Lackey's high school principal down in Texas. And I asked him about it, and he said that even in high school, every single person in that building fucking hated John Lackey's guts. He said from the teachers to the students to his own teammates, they all hated him. And I was like, yeah, that checks out. He really seems like a real piece of work.
So I know you don't follow football, but the 49ers were in the NFC Championship game and they're down to their third string quarterback, who was literally the last player taken in the draft. His name is Brock Purdy. And he had been 8-0, mostly because, almost entirely because, the 49ers infrastructure is so good that he needed to not screw it up. He ended up getting hurt in the championship game. They lost. But during that game, there were so many people who were like, oh yeah, I was in high school with Brock Purdy and he told me I was going to hell for smoking weed. It was like all sorts of variations of the story from like 5-10 different people that just got amplified.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of that.
Don't be a dick. Yeah. If you're a high school athlete, those stories will get out.
I mean, Lackey's a great choice. Like, I almost thought of putting David Price on here for the same reason.
Well, I don't think he is there any evidence that he was a clubhouse cancer? I'm a David
he
Price
just didn't
defender
want,
and will be to the day
me,
I die.
I'm a defender of his performance. Yeah. I think his performance was serially underrated.
But even like his ex stuff, he was defending a teammate. Like, do we have any evidence that his teammates didn't love him?
I don't care. I didn't like it. But yes, you're right. That's not the exercise, which is why I didn't put him on the list.
Good.
You know, I'm just going to go with the absolute most obvious one I can at the moment and say Carl Crawford.
Oh my God. Wait a minute. That's a good pick, except that when you said, I'm going to go with the most obvious one, and that's
second
Carl,
most obvious.
I was expecting a different last name on that.
Oh, can I tell you something better?
Sure.
I meant Carl Everett, but they both, let's go.
Okay.
I meant Carl Everett.
That's
I was
the
like, that doesn't
one.
Sound right. Yeah, that's what
the
I
most
meant.
Obvious one.
I meant Carl Everett, but they both, it works for both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Carl Everett was, there was this era of early sabermetrics among front offices where people like Paul D. Podesta would get out there and say, I'd take a team of 9 Milton Bradleys if I had to. Now, look. There's one thing where you can't predict how clubhouse chemistry is going to go. You get another case, like if you trade for Kyrie Irving, say, there's going to be business eventually. And that was true of Carl Everett. I remember I was in upstate New York at my then girlfriend's house, and I had to run out to get something and came back. Her brother's like, well, Carl Everett's out for the year. What are you talking about? And it was, I had missed the home plate argument. Mm-hmm. And it was just never, I mean, he did one great thing.
Breaking up Mike Mussina's perfect game.
Which was like the most Carl Everett thing you could possibly do.
Yeah. I mean, he did one great thing, but he was also just outstanding that first year in general.
Yeah, he was great.
What did he hit, like 35 home runs?
But it never felt sustainable. And the reason it never felt sustainable is it wasn't for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. 34 home runs his first season with the Red Sox. 300, 373, 587.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But I think he is outside. Okay. Yes, I meant Carl Everett. Carl Crawford would also apply. We can just lump him in here. We don't need to go over it twice because he was also seemed not happy from the jump. And I think Carl Everett would be the second most obvious choice,
mm-hmm.
given the remaining candidates. So I'll let you go next.
All right. Well, so an interesting thing about Carl Everett as clubhouse cancer, I specifically remember that season when it all started spiraling with him. That there were probably a couple of stories, probably a whole genre of stories that appeared like in the Globe that time, where they would talk to his Astros teammates and be like, "Hey, what the hell's the deal with this?" And the Astros teammates never said there was like didn't seem to have a problem with Carl Everett, and in fact they said this is I think where the phrase originated because it became kind of a thing around Boston a little bit. The Astros teammates would always just say, "Yeah, Carl was trouble." But that's just Carl being Carl. And then 2 years later, Manny Ramirez shows up. And Manny takes that Carl being Carl phrase. And boy, does he just take that and run with it and make it his own. And now in retrospect, I mean, I still love Manny forever. And this is an interesting thing about like, what is being a clubhouse cancer even really mean? Because he was amazing and his Red Sox teams were amazing. And you can talk, I found this article that another possible clubhouse cancer, Jonathan Papelbon, after Manny left and went to the Dodgers, I mean, he ripped him a new one and came out and said some awful things and came out and straight up said that they were better off without him. But that's very clearly not true. It's very obvious to me that Manny Ramirez did not make the Red Sox worse in any way, shape, or form. No matter how often he argued with Curt Schilling, no matter how often he pushed a traveling secretary, which we can all agree that's the worst thing he did by far, pushing a man who was, what, in his 70s at the time? But still, like, I mean, he was the best right-handed hitter in the game. The Red Sox won a shit ton of games while he anchored the heart of their lineup. So, you know, I don't know. Is Manny Ramirez clubhouse cancer? He's on every one of those lists. If you look up biggest baseball clubhouse cancers, but certainly didn't seem to have much of an impact on the Red Sox.
Negative. Oh, so you're picking him.
Oh, I'm picking him. Yeah. I'm picking for, him and saying
you could pick 2008 Manny Ramirez, 2007, 2008. That's fine. He wasn't the best right-handed hitter in the game. I'm sorry to break it to you. To quote Peter Gammons when confronted with the exact same statement during the time it was happening, said, "Oh, have you ever heard of Albert Pujols?"
Yeah, Albert Pujols did exist. That is true.
The one time that Manny was emphatically better than Albert Pujols and any other hitter I've seen in my life, minus pretty much the last X number of years of Barry Bonds and very few exceptions, was right when he got traded to the Dodgers.
I thought you were going to say the 2004 World Series.
Sure. But there was nothing like that when he was on the Dodgers. He was as good as he ever was. It was incredible. And as good as hitters rarely get to that space. Like even J.D. Martinez in 2018 was like, he was close. But
he would go on those runs twice a year, twice a season with the Red Sox. I think the one he did with that'd be interesting to actually look at the numbers. And was his run with the Dodgers really that much better, or was it just easier to see because he was just traded to the Dodgers when a player changes teams and goes to Hollywood and he starts that streak right at that point, it just becomes clear to see as opposed to a streak he started on July 2nd.
It was a much better streak. In over 229 plate appearances, he batted .396, .489, .743.
Okay, yes, that is insane.
Now look, he finished 2000 in Cleveland with a .697 slugging, so it's not like he was too far off. Yeah. And he probably had that sort of stretch there too. Yeah, I mean, your point stands.
That's insane.
But in terms of showcasing it, and he was 36 at the time, that was one of the most amazing things. And I guess I'll just... I don't want to take Schilling, though I feel some sort of... I feel compelled. Can I just lump Schilling and Papelbon together?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Just the loudmouths.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you were good. Like, I'm not... No shade. You were good. But if they made us annoyed with how much they were yapping, I would imagine their team, especially Schilling, who, as we noted... As you noted, argued with Manny. They just didn't seem like pleasant guys to be around, and Bryce Harper, I think, would at least back us up one of those.
Yeah, Papelbon, man, it's amazing. Like I loved that kid so much when he came up, and now if I see his name anywhere in a story or something, I just roll my eyes. I just don't want to hear from Jonathan Papelbon anymore.
A friend of mine,
and Schilling, of course, is that goes without saying. I said this in the office Slack once. I think there is money, if not money, at least internet clout to be made by somebody who takes 4 days in October and photoshops out Kurt Schilling's body in every one of those scenes and replaces it with, like, I don't know, Grimace from McDonald's or something, and then puts that on YouTube so that you can watch 4 days in October without having to see or listen to Kurt Schilling.
It's really such a conundrum, because even if you think there was some sort of showmanship involved, he went out there and did the damn thing.
He did do the damn thing, yeah.
It's crazy. A friend of mine, his wife, when Papelbon was on the Phillies, called him ass face because of the way he would pucker his lips like that.
Yeah,
sure. Asshole. All right, last one. Go for it.
Okay, my last one. I am going to go with a person who is one of the top 10, if not top 5, maybe, most famous Americans of all time. But in researching this, I actually think still probably deserves to be more famous. Babe Ruth. I don't know how much you know about Babe Ruth's Red Sox career, but my God, this dude was ahead of his time in terms of being like, if his career existed today, I mean, he's like Terrell Owens combined with.
You don't need, there's literally a perfect example of who he would be. You don't, this is no longer a thought exercise because Shohei Ohtani exists.
Well, okay. No. But I'm talking about his off field exploits. I'll get to Shohei for a second. Let me just run you through some Babe Ruth clubhouse cancer highlights. He was a rookie in 1914. Had a fine rookie season, obviously, mostly as a pitcher. 1915, he slumped, according to the Society of American Baseball Research, in part because of his excessive carousing with fellow pitcher Dutch Leonard and a broken toe that he sustained by kicking the bench in frustration after he was intentionally walked that kept him out of the starting rotation for 2 weeks. In 1917... facing Washington on June 23rd, Babe Ruth walked the first Senators batter on four pitches. First batter, four pitches. Feeling squeezed by home plate umpire Brick Owens, Ruth stormed off the mound and punched Owens in the head. After Ruth was ejected in that game, Ernie Shore came in to relieve. The base runner who Ruth had walked was thrown out trying to steal, and Shore then retired the next 26 hitters. Babe Ruth only got a 10-game suspension and a $100 fine for punching the home plate umpire in the face that day. In 1918, this is when Ruth had started to hit a little bit. Ruth was in a fight with Red Sox management because he wanted to stop pitching. He wanted to hit because he could see the future, and he could see that he was on the verge of changing sports as we know it forever. Red Sox management did not want him to hit. They wanted him to pitch. He quit the team in July, in the middle of the season. He quit. New York Times headline, July 4th, 1918. Babe Ruth jumps Red Sox, will play in shipbuilding league. He quit the Red Sox in the middle of a World Series winning season and temporarily joined a league of shipbuilders while he supported a nascent players union that, of course, would not actually get off the ground for another couple of decades. He did return to the Red Sox a few days later, obviously, of course, and ended up winning the World Series with them in 1918. Here's his quote when he returned, because again, he was fighting with the Red Sox because he only wanted to hit. And so this is where Shohei comes in. I don't think a man can pitch in his regular turn and play every other game at some other position and keep that pace year after year, Ruth said. I can do this all season right and not feel it, for I am young and strong and I don't mind the work. But I wouldn't guarantee to do it for many seasons. And then before the 1919 season, he once again held out in spring training. He was seeking to double his salary. He held out and threatened publicly that he was going to become a boxer. And then, of course, the Red Sox obviously sold him to the Yankees. Oh, I lost the quote. Where's the Frizzy quote? Let me see if I can find it. Anyway, there's a wonderful Harry Frizzy quote. After the sale, where he says, like, it doesn't matter how good Babe Ruth is. No team can be successful when one player rows one way while the other team is rowing the other way. And obviously the rest is history. We don't need to go over how wrong Harry Frizzy was. So I'm going with Babe Ruth, a delightfully fun and colorful clubhouse cancer who, despite being one of the 10 most famous Americans, probably should be more famous.
Well, let's go from arguably the best hitter of all time to arguably the best pitcher of all time. My last choice will be Roger Clemens, who has gotten a bad rap in some ways, but in other ways has earned any of the vitriol people say.
What ways do you think he's gotten a bad rap?
Well, people say that he gave up on the Red Sox. He showed up overweight. His last season on the Red Sox, he pitched 242 innings, led the league in strikeouts. Yeah. And yeah, he was 10-13. His FIP, which we look at now, was 3.43. That's fine. Now, yeah, the year before, he didn't pitch a full season and his ERA was over 4. But looking at his stats, I would hardly, and now look, a lot of this is refracted by all that comes after he leaves, where he wins four more.
Well, that's the thing. Like Duquette was so right to say that he was in the twilight of his career when they let him go. He was 33 years old. He was 33 years old. He was a clear step down from his peak, and then he roided it up and became the best pitcher of all time.
Okay, so, fair. But I do think that he was still. I think he was still trying all those times, and he was a pitcher, and shit happened. And then, yes, he took steroids and was even better than he had been before, arguably. But he's just such the obvious choice. As I've said on this, I love him as a color guy because I actually think he's really good. And clearly the organization doesn't have bad blood with him because they let him back, you know? They let him back to do these Nesson color guy stuff. And I think a lot of Clemens, anti-Clemens stuff comes from steroid stuff that happened after, and then his like contract stuff and
Roger, he's in Roger's box.
Yeah. But very, very easy choice to round us out here.
You're right. I guess you're right. When I came online as a baseball fan, Clemens was the name on the Red Sox, of course. But his whole career
can be traced to saying good things about Larry Bird and saying bad things about Roger Clemens. He's obviously run with it. No shade. Those were his things that he wrote about very early on.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. I wasn't cognizant enough to know like how much the media created this perception, but by the time I came online, the impression to me as a 7 or 8 year old or whatever was that like, oh, Roger Clemens is like that. I don't know if I would have thought he was like a bum as a 7 or 8 year old, but it's clearly like, oh, Roger Clemens is the guy in the Red Sox who is the big Red Sox player, but is disgruntled and doesn't pitch to his potential.
I mean, a guy like Roger Clemens and a guy like Dan Shaughnessy are made for each other in bad times.
Yeah.
Those two things are just going to play off each other. But I think that Clemens, I mean, the same way I defend Price's actual performance on the Red Sox, same with to some degree with Clemens, but
let me ask you
more than enough to earn. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think Dan Shaughnessy is aware of how totally irrelevant he is today? Like within the Red Sox world? Because nobody cares about Dan Shaughnessy at all right now. Nobody under the age of 30 has ever read a single word he's written. And it's a combination of some sad things, obviously, the decline of the newspaper industry. But he's also just so out of step with how modern baseball works and how to think about it and talk about it. But
I Murray Chass from the Times writing about the Yankees, and then when he left the Times and he's writing these just nasty, mean-spirited blogs that nobody cares about. Yeah. Like, dude, do you think
Dan Shaughnessy knows that like literally no one under the age of 30 has ever read a word he's written?
Yeah, probably. I think he probably uses that as fuel to fire up his.
I don't even know if he has a computer. I don't know if he has internet access. I really don't. He might be completely clueless. He may be pulling up his typewriter every day and thinking, I'm going to set Red Sox Nation on fire with this one, completely unaware of, oblivious to the fact that whatever he writes these days is just like a fart in the wind. Nobody cares.
He's just miserable. He's a miserable person.
Yeah.
Or at least that's, look, don't know the man. Comes across as miserable. That's our draft. Dan, would you like to know my enemy of the week?
I always want to know your mortal enemy of the week. Let's hear it. Brian Joyner's mortal enemy of the week for February 6th through 10th.
It's barf. Because last week my son barfed at school and I had to pick him up. And then yesterday my daughter barfed right after school And she is here. Lila, you want to say hi? Say it loudly. No, you got to say it.
Hi.
Okay, that's Lila. The only advantage to having Lila home instead of Sam is that Sam needed help with The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, whereas Lila doesn't need help. So she's been playing quietly the whole time.
That's nice.
But Barf. Yeah.
That's a good mortal enemy. That's Barf, a good mortal enemy.
You're on the list, Barf. Yeah.
God, is there anything worse than throwing up? It's funny that there was a 6-year period in my life where throwing up was a pretty regular occurrence. It's just like something I accepted as the cost of doing business.
Yeah.
And now if I throw up, it's just like the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. I could share a story about barfing now myself, but I won't because I don't want to.
Appreciate that.
How about recommendations, Dan? Do you have one?
I do have a recommendation. So this is barf. This isn't quite as bad as barf, but it's also awful. I've had some post-nasal drip for like 4 weeks straight now.
This is the story that I spared you. It's all post-nasal drip.
It's the worst. I don't know. This has been the worst winter I can ever remember for diseases.
Oh, but I love February and my name is Dan.
Well, February is usually when it should clear up. And I think it will clear up. But this has been awful. But this morning, it's getting better, but it felt bad this morning. I stopped in at a 7-Eleven and I picked up something that I've never heard of and was really suspicious of. It's called Exposed and it is a aloe vera and honey drink. I didn't know you could drink aloe vera, but you can. And this thing is delicious.
Ooh.
It's the company is called ALO. I was a little nervous about it. What ended up putting me over the top was that I saw that it was, it was made in Taiwan. I saw that and I was like, okay, I need to go with some ancient Eastern home remedies here. So I picked it up and it's delicious. And there are, I mean, depending on, a lot of people have weird things with texture. There are like globs of aloe vera floating in this, which I didn't know there would be. And it caught me off guard the first time one of those slipped down my throat. But this thing is very good and it's making my throat feel good. So it's aloe, A-L-O, exposed, aloe vera and honey drink. Pick it up at your local 7-Eleven today.
Dan, with a recommendation. My recommendation is Chef's Table Pizza, which I started watching. It's very fun if you want to see different pizza chefs from basically America and Italy, but all around the world, talk about how each one of them found the secret to good pizza. And you know what it is, Dan? It's the dough. It's always the dough.
Of course it is. Yeah. It's 90% of the pizza.
We'll dovetail that with my divorced dad thing of the week, which I've now started to make my own dough because I'm inspired by watching those chefs dig their hands into dough. It's just very, you know, people are into ASMR, which is like sights and sounds. I don't know if that, I like it because it slows me down, gets me working with food. And I'm going to try to just make a batch every day because they say, like, look, you do this stuff every day, you'll start to realize what works and what doesn't. I kind of need that. I need something like that in my life. So
need a little structure, need some dough structure.
Exactly. And something to,
you could also write something for the website if you're looking for something to do. Let me throw that suggestion out there. That's my recommendation of the week. My recommendation of the week, if you're a deputy editor of a Red Sox website and you're looking for something to do, write something for that site.
I need to point out that you did own me last week also, where you called attention to the article where my name is the first two words.
Yeah.
But I didn't know I was the deputy editor. So now I'm like, oh, shit.
I didn't give you that title. I inherited you with that title.
Matt didn't even tell me the title. I think he just told Vox what the title was.
Gotcha. Okay. I can change it if you want.
No, please don't. Please don't.
I can make you the divorced dad in chief.
I mean, I think that you don't need to give me that title. I think we got that. That not the not Jake in chief. But okay. Yeah, I'll write something, guys. Guys, I'll write something.
Ooh.
And I think that promise is a good place to end.
Can't wait to follow.
Find me. Week. on Twitter at Brian Joiner, BryanJoiner. You could follow Dan on Twitter at Dan Secatore, DanSecatore. We will be back as the season approaches. Dan, enjoy that beverage.
You too. Next time we speak, pitchers and catchers will have reported.
They will have. It's getting close, guys. It's getting close. Until next time.